I'm Alexander Hefner, your host on The Open Mind. I'm delighted to welcome to the podcast today Ari Cohn. He is a First Amendment and defamation lawyer and a fellow at Tech Freedom who is an expert on Section 230 issues. You can follow him for his studious hot takes on 230 issues at Ari Cohn. Welcome, Ari.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Ari, when it comes to Section 230, as you point out often on Twitter, there's so much garbage and so much politically expedient argumentation about the merit of 230, the opposition to 230. What are the most important things for people to know about 230?
It's going to tell how much time you got.
Right.
But I think the thing that most people just need to realize is Section 230 is, at its core, a pretty basic thing. And the thing that's relevant to most people is that Section 230 protects providers of interactive computer services, think Facebook, Twitter, apps. That term is fairly broad, and its users from liability based on the content provided by a user, which means if I tweet something and it's defamatory, Twitter can't be sued because I used their servers to post it. Likewise, if I retweet somebody else's defamatory tweet and don't add any of my own commentary, the author of that tweet is going to be liable for defamation, but not me. That's when people think about Section 230, that's a lot of what's been going on in the public zeitgeist. There is a lot more to it in terms of protection for blocking capabilities that people provide to others and content moderation decisions by Twitter. And that's all, another part where people get really kind of their bee in their bonnet about content moderation. But the long and short of it is, Section 230 protects users and website owners and app providers, what have you, from liability. And I think that the thing that often gets lost in the discussion is we're talking all about how big tech has so much control over the public discourse. What Section 230 does is make it easier for companies, big and small, to exist. But the power that, say, Twitter has to moderate content, to ban people, doesn't come from Section 230. That comes from the First Amendment, which provides them an expressive and associative right to have or not have anyone or any kind of speech that they want on their platform.
Social media ought to be liable for its town square, if you don't want to call it a publication, to the extent that it's being exploited for nefarious or terroristic purposes. They ought to be liable for expressions on their site.
Why ought they be liable for that? Why not hold the people who actually said those bad things responsible for that? The point of Section 230 is that there's so much content that's posted nonstop on the internet that it is just literally impossible to do content moderation in a way that is even close to perfect, let alone perfect. It's just an impossible task. And what you would do if you got rid of Section 230 is either, most likely, if platforms would have to simply stop moderating whatsoever. And then what you have is even more of this stuff that people want to hold, let's say, Twitter liable for, because they've just stopped moderating everything for fear of liability. Or, the other possibility is that they start over moderation, and then you have people getting booted left and right when there's even a whiff of somebody saying something that could potentially result in liability. Either way, the internet as we know it would not be able to function. When people say that Twitter ought to be held liable, I'm not sure that there's a really compelling argument for that.
The fact that they finally decided to self-govern or self-moderate in a strategically significant way with the removal of Donald Trump's account in the aftermath of the Capitol insurrection and the tweeted an incitement of followers to engage in criminal activity, that is a recognition of many incidents over recent years in which Donald Trump's tweets and the emergence of a following of conspiracy theorists and hate groups and domestic terrorists all precipitated some of those events. It was, my question to you is not Jack Dorsey's decision and Mark Zuckerberg's decision to remove those accounts, isn't that evidence that they were culpable in prior instances of instigated violence, you know, dating back to probably before the beginning of the Trump administration, but certainly if you think of the attacks on journalists in Maryland at a newspaper, you think about the Tree of Life synagogue massacre, and then you think of all of the tweets of the press or the enemy of the people.
I don't think that's necessarily true. I mean, certainly, I mean, if you're going to ask me, you know, Donald Trump's tweeting has been unhinged for quite some time. And yeah, sure, some of it has had some deleterious effects. But here's the thing. You get rid of Section 230, and what happens is if they start moderating some things, then they're going to be liable for everything. And then you just have them not moderating anything, which results in the same bad speech being allowed. And, you know, I really, you know, it's kind of normal and natural for people to really say there ought to be a law and to hope that law can fix all of our societal ills. But when it comes down to it, and this goes far beyond the world of the internet, is the law can't fix all of our problems. And content moderation is difficult. Nobody is arguing that I've seen that social media companies get it right all the time, or even get it right most of the time. It is an incredibly fast-paced, ever-changing, overwhelming endeavor that will never be perfect. It is impossible for it ever to be perfect. And I think that the best we can do is to create a situation where we're encouraging companies to innovate in moderation and to find new things that are responsive to the demands of society, to the demands of their customer base, to their shareholders, what have you. The more that we can foster an environment where they can respond to those concerns without fear of liability because they've responded to those concerns, the better off we're all going to be. Because what we don't want is an internet where all the social media companies throw up their hands and say, well, if I moderate anything, then I'm going to face all these crazy lawsuits. So everyone can just post everything. That's clearly a situation that nobody really wants.
Do you think that there's a way to reform or modify 230 to incorporate the fact that these sites have been and are shielded as a result of 230 in a very broad way, but still allow for the freedom and moderation capacity and the independence to moderate that you describe? Is there a way to reform 230 that is cognizant of both issues?
Not that I've seen. And frankly, I can't really envision a way that would actually address the problems that people are seeing. You know, the thing that really sticks in my craw is that every time you see, you know, the right-leaning argument about Section 230 is that social media platforms are banning conservatives and yada, yada, yada. And so get rid of these, you know, protections they have. But the fact of the matter is that repealing Section 230 does absolutely nothing to stop that, because they have a First Amendment right to do it anyway. And all that means is that the people that are saying we should repeal Section 230 because of that are trying to punish Twitter for the exercise of their First Amendment rights. I find that problematic. But then on the left side, you have the argument that we need to have, you know, hold websites accountable for the damaging effects of speech that other people post on it. But again, the law can't solve everything. And the underlying problem is that you need an actual cause of action already. Repealing Section 230 doesn't create new things that you can sue social media for. So, you know, there's not going to be this general sense that if we, without Section 230, you can sue social media companies for bad things that happen. There still has to be a legitimate basis for a lawsuit. And a lot of people overlook that fact. They think, oh, you could sue social media companies for anything without Section 230. And that's just not the case. So I think that the locus of analysis is being cast very far askew, very widely askew by all these politically convenient, as you put it, arguments that kind of ignore the core problem that people are complaining about. Is you pay attention to what people are actually saying their problems with social media companies are, by and large, those wouldn't be fixed by getting rid of Section 230. That would just result in unnecessary upheaval of the entire internet infrastructure.
The argument that is employed to suggest that social media are publishers is to relate them to newspapers or broadcast channels, which under FCC rules and other regulation have had to comport themselves in a way that social media have not been forced to. Now, I suppose your argument would be that those who want to analogize traditional media like newspapers or television stations and social media just don't understand that they're different entities and that social media are more utilities than publications. But what is the response to the idea that in this climate, even during the Trump presidency, media survived, and despite the fact that they can be sued, you know, the New York Times and Washington Post and many national outlets grew in subscriptions and economic vitality over these years, and they are vulnerable to being sued at any moment. You're saying that abolishing 230 would put social media out of business in some way, or it would cause tumult. But what about this comparison that's drawn to mainstream press, specifically newspapers and TV?
Well, I wouldn't exactly call social media utility either. That has a whole bevy of other implications that simply just don't fit in the way that, for instance, the electric company fits. But that aside, I think the number one counter argument to that has to be the sheer scope. When you think about the content decisions that, for instance, the New York Times, even one of the bigger newspapers, makes on a day-to-day basis, it has got to be 1/1,000,000th of the amount of content decisions that a social media company would have to make probably in an hour of every single day of the year. Like, the magnitude of content produced and posted is so much greater that there is no way to build an infrastructure to adequately, at least no way that we currently possess. Who knows with artificial intelligence and machine learning what might happen someday, but as it stands, there is simply no way to create a process by which you can actually effectively moderate that much content to the same extent as the New York Times picking out letters to the editor. It's just not possible. And I think that anybody who doesn't grasp that really just doesn't understand the magnitude of the internet infrastructure. It's just, I mean, as important as people say it is to our day-to-day lives and discussion, you know, if you don't grasp how enormous that universe of data is, it wouldn't make sense.
You're not arguing that these websites lack a publishing designation. You're not arguing that they lack a publishing designation, that they are publications. You're saying that there are publications that are just too vast for the kind of scrutiny to be practicable that is undertaken at CNN or the New York Times.
Yeah, that's essentially it. When you look at the cases that kind of preceded the creation of Section 230, they impose liability for either attempting to moderate some content or having been made sufficiently aware of the defamatory or other tortious content of publications they distributed. That is maybe a feasible framework for traditional media. Again, with the amount of content on the internet, it is simply not feasible. And that is why there is no requirement in Section 230 that something be a, quote, neutral platform, as disinformation artists like Ted Cruz like to claim, versus a publisher. There is no distinction. What happened is Section 230 was passed to say they are not the publisher of user-generated content. They are not legally considered the publisher. In a broad philosophical sense, might they be a publisher? Sure. We have chosen to make them legally not responsible as a publisher because of the inherent problems with the internet and the vast amount of content that's created on it. And to be clear, Section 230 was a law that was ahead of its time. It really foresaw the way that the internet would change our lives. And the amount of data was big back then, and it's just astronomically higher now. And I that is the point. The point is not we're going to create these neutral platforms. The point is we want companies to be able to moderate content without being besieged by lawsuits, many of which the companies would win anyways on First Amendment grounds, but it would be very expensive and time consuming to deal with them. But Section 230 specifically countenances companies making their own content moderation decisions and responding to customers in different ways. It is inherently a market-based solution that allows customers to go to another provider if they don't like what another one is doing. You saw people go to Gab or go to Parler or whatever because they weren't happy with what Twitter or Facebook were doing. And that's the kind of market-based solution that Section 230 envisions. And I think that trying to tear that down is destructive and does not really help the problems that people are perceiving with the internet.
Donald Trump wanted to tie the stimulus checks to abolishing 230. And now we likely know why, because perhaps he understood that if he was not reelected or certified as the next president, that he would engage in acts that would lead him to be pushed off the platform. Now, there's the argument about 230 that Trump doesn't like some of the things he sees on Twitter, hashtags that are offensive to him or injurious to his political brand or his company. And then there's the idea that calling for the abolition of 230 would have potentially eroded his own influence on Twitter if there was, Twitter could no longer operate, and that Twitter was being sued to oblivion. But do you have a sense as to why Trump supports 230 abolition and how that may differ from people like Cruz and Hawley? What are they really motivated by?
Frankly, Donald Trump is motivated by ego, in my view. He doesn't like that Twitter is appending warnings to his tweets, and they don't like that they're doing things that he perceives as delegitimizing him or his message, but also because he knows that his base is really riled up about it. Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley, famous purveyors of disinformation about Section 230, are perhaps less motivated by ego than they are about vote hawking. They're trying to tap into that same political base that Donald Trump has and ingratiate themselves to it so that they can further their own political ambitions. That's the long and short of it. It's hard to pinpoint what Donald Trump believes at any particular moment of the day, so it's kind of hard to really come to a conclusion about his motivations. But, if I had to guess, it's going to be ego.
Pre-insurrection, the donations from Facebook and other tech companies, and you would see Republicans, including Republicans who voted against certifying the election results. We've seen now a wave of corporate America that wants to be committed to democracy and is ceasing any further contributions to candidates or lawmakers who opposed the democratic process, who wanted to overturn through authoritarian and violent means, in some cases, the election of 2020. Given where we are and the balance in Congress, do you think that it's plausible in this new, in this next 2 year period, that there would be any real reform of 230 or related statutes in connection with social media and social media liability or responsibility? Not necessarily 230, but anything else that might affect the way social media operate. Are you anticipating that any of this will be legislated over the next 2 years?
Well, I think that, you know, this is very much at the forefront of public discussion right now. And I think that just the end of the Trump administration is not going to quell the public discussion about it. I think, you know, over the past year, we've seen a flurry of generally poorly written and thought out proposals to reform Section 230, and Congress doing what it does. I assume that they will continue to put out flawed, poorly thought out proposals in the future. But I think actually what you just said is, you know, another important point that people often miss. And you talked about contributions from social media companies to even Republican legislators. You know, the biggest, people often, you know, cite big tech as the target of their fight against Section 230. But the biggest gift that you could give to big tech is getting rid of Section 230. Facebook, Twitter, they have the resources to at least stave off a lot of these lawsuits. They can deal with it. It would be a pain in the butt. It would cost them time and money. They could do it. You know who couldn't would be smaller operators. And that would price all new competitors pretty much immediately out of the market. You could not create a competitor to any of the big social media companies without Section 230. The liability risks alone would just completely wreck it. So yeah, Facebook would probably really love if Section 230 went away, because they'd have no more competition. You know, any of these big companies, big tech would be absolutely thrilled on the whole, because their position as powerful market players would pretty much be solidified. Who is going to start up a social media company when the possibility of getting sued into oblivion is just so front and center, and not even just possible? People are looking for ways to do it.
You're saying is 230 as a boogeyman or as some kind of a vehicle for real reform is just a front. It's not realistic, and it's not actually coherent as an argument or the strategic way to make reforms.
I think that's absolutely correct. I don't think anyone is arguing content moderation is done perfectly. There are certainly ways that it can be improved, and there are certainly policy decisions that can and should be considered when making content moderation decisions. And those can fluctuate and those can change and they can be reversed. But removing the legal framework that allows those discussions to happen without worrying about liability at every step of the way is going to wreck that progress instead of encourage it. So yeah, I think people are focusing on the wrong thing, and what they're focusing on are, you know, basically political pointy sticks. You know, they're using them to stab their opponents instead of actually working towards things that will address problems.
When we ask ourselves what does have to happen for there to be competing platforms, that, you know, that there is a company that would have the freedom to compete, doesn't that have to do with users' mobility and basically their ability to move from one platform to another with their friends, with their connections, and any kind of antitrust lawsuit that is attempting to break up these companies would be strategically advised to require, in addition to any monetary change or any structural change that the court would force. The real issue seems to be creating other platforms where people are able to bring their content that they own or their friends and connections from Facebook to a competing platform.
Well, so, I mean, the fact of the matter is users do have mobility. You saw people claiming en masse that they would ditch Twitter for Parler. And, you know, a lot of them stayed on Twitter too, but Parler grew really fast.
There's no mechanism, and this is what a court could potentially impose. There's no mechanism to bring your friends, or in the case of LinkedIn, your connections, to basically transpose it onto another platform, right? You can start a new account, but you can't start, you have to start from scratch if you're going to do that.
Sure, but I'm not sure that's necessarily an antitrust concern. And, you know, frankly, I think a lot of the antitrust talk is severely overblown, given by how many different companies are doing this, which shows that competition is happening and it is strong. Yeah, sometimes you're going to have bigger players than others. And to be clear, I'm not an antitrust expert, but, you know, it seems to me like competition is actually doing pretty well right now. So I think that people are just really looking for ways to hit at tech companies. They're not as interested in actual, you know, principled arguments. They're interested in revenge.
In the case of the defamation lawsuits that are going forward against TV stations and presumably some social media personalities that attacked Dominion voting systems and said that Dominion was illegitimate, that it was owned by other countries, that the votes were not being tabulated correctly. Your description of liability means that Twitter or Facebook is not liable for Sidney Powell's tweets, but that a Newsmax, for instance, that would host her, or that maybe even she, as the one posting this on social media, would be responsible. What is the likelihood of real punishment if the Smartmatics and the Dominions follow through on their suits against Powell, Newsmax, and Co.?
You know, I'm not particularly a fan of defamation suits in general, as somebody who defends against them for clients. However, I think that when you're looking at the universe of defamation lawsuits, this is an above average risk to Sidney Powell at all. I mean, for instance, you know, to break it down, the hardest part about getting past the initial stage of a defamation lawsuit when it involves a public figure, and Dominion would be a public figure, is pleading actual malice, that somebody spoke with reckless disregard for the truth. Well, Sidney Powell said she had a video that said something. If Dominion claims no such video exists, which they did in their lawsuit, and that it is literally impossible that she could have thought that that was the truth, that is probably enough to clear one of the biggest hurdles. Then you get to discovery, which will be broad, and it will be intense for Sidney Powell. And, you know, I think that there's just a really high risk level for her, you know, higher than most lawsuits that you see these days in the defamation world. There's a million and one different things that can happen in between now and a verdict. So, you know, the list of hypotheticals could go on and on. All I can say is that, you know, I would not be sitting very comfortably if I were Sidney Powell.
Ari Cohn, First Amendment and defamation lawyer, fellow at Tech Freedom. Thank you so much for your insight today.
No problem, Alex. Thanks for having me.